time for me to rest. I could step aside and let others pass upon a path to a very special place, to a forest of giant fir, cedar, and hemlock, to the ancient forest that was. He was right, and many have followed the path he blazed from weedy brambles to old-growth children. Franz Dolp passed away in 2004 in a collision with a paper mill truck on his way to Shot Pouch Creek. Outside the door of his cabin, the circle of young cedars looked like women in green shawls, beaded with raindrops catching the light, graceful dancers in feathery fringe that sways with their steps. They spread their branches wide, opening the circle, inviting us to be part of the dance of regeneration. Clumsy at first, from generations of sitting on the sidelines, we stumble until we find the rhythm. We know these steps from deep memory, handed down from Sky Woman, reclaiming our responsibility as co-creators. Here in a homemade forest, poets, writers, scientists, foresters, shovels, seeds, elk, and alder join in the circle with Mother Cedar, dancing the old-growth children into being. We're all invited. Pick up a shovel and join the dance. Witness to the rain. This Oregon rain, at the start of winter, falls steadily in sheets of gray, unimpeded, making a gentle hiss. You'd think that rain falls equally over the land, but it doesn't. The rhythm and the tempo change markedly from place to place. In a tangle of salal and Oregon grape, the rain strikes rat-a-tat-tat on the hard, shiny leaves, the snare drum of sclerophylls. Rhododendron leaves, broad and flat, receive the rain with a smack that makes the leaves bounce and rebound, dancing in the downpour. Beneath a massive hemlock, the drops are fewer, and the craggy trunk knows rain as dribbles down its furrows. On bare soil, the rain splats on the clay, while fir needles swallow it up with an audible gulp. In contrast, the fall of rain on moss is nearly silent. I kneel among them, sinking into their softness, to watch and to listen. The drops are so quick that my eye is always chasing, but not catching, their arrival. At last, by narrowing my gaze to just a single frond, I can see it. The impact bows the shoot downward, but the drop itself vanishes. It is soundless. There is no drip or splash, but I can see the front of water move, darkening the stem as it is drunk in, silently dissipating among the tiny shingled leaves. Most other places I know, water is a discrete entity. It is hemmed in by well-defined boundaries, lake shores, stream banks, the great rocky coastline. You can stand at its edge and say, "This is water, and this is land." Those fish and those tadpoles are of the water realm. These trees, these mosses, and these four-leggeds are creatures of the land. But here in these misty forests, those edges seem to blur, with rain so fine and constant as to be indistinguishable from air, and cedars wrapped with clouds so dense that only their outlines emerge. Water doesn't seem to make a clear distinction between gaseous phase and liquid. The air merely touches a leaf or a tendril of my hair, and suddenly a drop appears. Even the river, Lookout Creek, doesn't respect clear boundaries. It tumbles and slides down its main channel, where a dipper rides between pools. But Fred Swanson, a hydrologist here at the Andrews Experimental Forest, has told me stories of another stream, an invisible shadow of Lookout Creek, the hyperreic flow. This is the water that moves under the stream, in cobble beds and old sandbars. It edges up the tow slope to the forest, a wide unseen river that flows beneath the eddies and the splash, a deep invisible river, known to roots and rocks, the water and the land intimate beyond our knowing. It is hyperreic flow that I'm listening for. Wandering along the banks of Lookout Creek, I lean up against an old cedar with my back nestled in its curves and try to imagine the currents below. But all I sense is water dripping down my neck. Every branch is weighed down with mossy curtains of isothesium, and droplets hang from the tangled ends, just as they hang from my hair. When I bend my head over, I can see them both. But the droplets on the isothesium are far bigger than the drops on my bangs. In fact, the drops of moss water seem larger than any I know, and they hang, swelling and pregnant with gravity, far longer than the drops on me, or on twigs or bark. They dangle and rotate, reflecting the entire forest, and a woman and her bright yellow slicker. I'm not sure I can trust what I'm seeing. I wish I had a set of calipers so that I could measure the drops of moss water and see if they really are bigger. Surely all drops are created equal. I don't know, so I take refuge in the play of the scientist spinning out hypotheses. Perhaps the high humidity around moss makes the drops last longer. Maybe, in residence among mosses, raindrops absorb some property that increases their surface tension, making them stronger against the pull of gravity? Perhaps it's just an illusion, like how the full moon looks so much bigger at the horizon. Does the diminutive scale of the moss leaves make the drops appear larger? Maybe they just want to show off their sparkle just a little longer. After hours in the penetrating rain, I am suddenly damp and chilled, and the path back to the cabin is a temptation. I could so easily retreat to tea and dry clothes, but I cannot pull myself away. However alluring the thought of warmth, there is no substitute for standing in the rain to waken every sense, senses that are muted within four walls, where my attention would be on me instead of all that is more than me. Inside, looking out, I could not bear the loneliness of being dry in a wet world. Here in the rainforest, I don't want to be just a bystander to rain, passive and protected. I want to be part of the downpour, to be soaked along with the dark humus that squishes underfoot. I wish that I could stand like a shaggy cedar with rain seeping into my bark, that water could dissolve the barrier between us. I want to feel what the cedars feel and know what they know. But I am not a cedar, and I am cold. Surely there are places where the warm-blooded among us take refuge. There must be niches here and there where the rain does not reach. I try to think like a squirrel and find them. I poke my head into an undercut bank by the stream, but its back wall runs with rivulets. No shelter there, nor in the hollow of a tree fall where I hoped the upturned roots would slow the rain. A spider web hangs between two dangling roots. Even this is filled, a silken hammock cradling a spoonful of water. My hopes rise where the vine maples are bent low to form a moss-draped dome. I push aside the isothesium curtain and stoop to enter the tiny dark room, roofed with layers of moss. It's quiet and windless, just big enough for one. The light comes through the moss-woven roof like pinprick stars. But so do the drips. As I walk back to the trail, a giant log blocks the way. It has fallen from the tow slope out into the river, where its branches drag in the rising current. Its top rests on the opposite shore. Going under looks easier than going over, so I drop to my hands and knees, and here I find my dry place. The ground mosses are brown and dry, the soil soft and powdery. The log makes a roof overhead, more than a meter wide, in the wedge-shaped space where the slope falls away to the stream. I can stretch out my legs, the slope angle perfectly accommodating the length of my back. I let my head rest in a dry nest of hylocomium moss and sigh in contentment. My breath forms a cloud above me, up where brown tufts of moss still cling to the furrowed bark, embroidered with spider webs and wisps of lichen that haven't seen the sun since this tree became a log. This log, inches above my face, weighs many tons. All that keeps it from seeking its natural angle of repose on my chest is a hinge of fractured wood at the stump and cracked branches propped on the other side of the stream. It could loose those bonds at any moment. But given the fast tempo of raindrops and the slow tempo of tree falls, I feel safe in the moment. The pace of my resting and the pace of its falling run on different clocks. Time as objective reality has never made much sense to me. It's what happens that matters. How can minutes and years, devices of our own creation, mean the same thing to gnats and to cedars? 200 years is young for the trees whose tops this morning are hung with mist. It's an eye blink of time for the river, and nothing at all for the rocks. The rocks and the river and these very same trees are likely to be here in another 200 years if we take good care. As for me and that chipmunk and the cloud of gnats milling in a shaft of sunlight, we will have moved on. If there is meaning in the past and in the imagined future, it is captured in the moment. When you have all the time in the world, you can spend it not on going somewhere, but on being where you are. So I stretch out, close my eyes, and listen to the rain. The cushiony moss keeps me warm and dry, and I roll over on my elbow to look out on the wet world. The drops fall heavily on a patch of Niam insigne, right at eye level. This moss stands upright, nearly 2 inches tall. The leaves are broad and rounded, like a fig tree in miniature. One leaf among the many draws my eye because of its long tapered tip, so unlike the rounded edges of the others. The thread-like tip of the leaf is moving, animated in a most unplant-like fashion. The thread seems firmly anchored to the apex of the moss leaf, an extension of its pellucid green. But the tip is circling, waving in the air as if it is searching for something. Its motion reminds me of the way inchworms will rise up on their hind sucker feet and wave their long bodies about until they encounter the adjacent twig, to which they then attach their forelegs, release the back, and arch across the gulf of empty space. But this is no many-legged caterpillar. It is a shiny green filament, a moss thread lit from within like a fiber optic element. As I watch, the wandering thread touches upon a leaf just millimeters away. It seems to tap several times at the new leaf, and then, as if reassured, stretches itself out across the gap. It holds like a taut green cable, more than doubling its initial length. And for just a moment, the two mosses are bridged by the shining green thread. And then green light flows like a river across the bridge and vanishes, lost in the greenness of the moss. Is that not grace? To see an animal made of green light and water, a mere thread of a being who, like me, has gone walking in the rain. Down by the river, I stand and listen. The sound of individual raindrops is lost in the foaming white rush and smooth glide over rock. If you didn't know better, you might not recognize raindrops and rivers as kin. So different are the particular and the collective. I lean over a still pool, reach in my hand, and let the drops fall from my fingers, just to be sure. Between the forest and the stream lies a gravel bar, a jumble of rocks swept down from high mountains in a river-changing flood last decade. Willows and alders, brambles and moss have taken hold there, but this too shall pass, says the river. Alder leaves lie fallen on the gravel, their drying edges upturned to form leafy cups. Rainwater has pooled in several, and it is stained red-brown, like tea, from the tannins leached from the leaf. Strands of lichen lie scattered among them, where the wind has torn them free. Suddenly, I see the experiment I need to test my hypothesis. The materials are neatly laid out before me. I found two strands of lichen, equal in size and length, and blot them on my flannel shirt inside my raincoat. One strand I place in the leaf cup of red alder tea. The other I soak in a pool of pure rainwater. Slowly I lift them both up, side by side, and watch the droplets form at the ends of the strands. Sure enough, they are different. The plain water forms small, rapid drops that seem in a hurry to let go. But the droplets steeped in alder water grow large and heavy and then hang for a long moment before gravity pulls them away. I feel the grin spreading over my face with the aha moment. There are different kinds of drops, depending on the relationship between the water and the plant. If tannin-rich alder water increases the size of the drops, might not water seeping through a long curtain of moss also pick up tannins, making the big strong drops I thought I was seeing? One thing I've learned in the woods is that there is no such thing as random. Everything is steeped in meaning, colored by relationships, one thing with another. Where new gravel meets old shore, a still pool has formed beneath the overhanging trees. Cut off from the main channel, it fills from the rise of hyperreic flow, the water rising from below to fill the shallow basin where summer's daisies look surprised to be submerged 2 feet deep now that the rains have come. In summer, this pool was a flowery swale, now a sunken meadow that tells of the river's transition from low braided channel to the full banks of winter. It is a different river in August than October. You'd have to stand here a long time to know them both, and even longer to know the river that was here before the coming of the gravel bar, and the river that will be after it leaves. Perhaps we cannot know the river. But what about the drops? I stand for a long time by the still backwater pool and listen. It is a mirror for the falling rain and is textured all over by the fine and steady fall. I strain to hear only rain whisper among the many sounds and find that I can. It arrives with a high sprinkly sound, a shurr so light that it only blurs the glassy surface but does not disrupt the reflection. The pool is overhung with branches of vine maple reaching from the shore, a low spray of hemlock, and from the gravel bar, alder stems inclining over the edge. Water falls from these trees into the pool, each to its own rhythm. The hemlock makes a rapid pulse. Water collects on every needle, but travels to the branch tips before falling, running to the drip line, where it releases in a steady pit, 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 drawing a dotted line in the water below. Maple stems shed their water much differently. The drips from maple are big and heavy. I watch them form and then plummet to the surface of the pool. They hit with such force that the drop makes a deep and hollow sound. Bloink. The rebound causes the water to jump from the surface, so it looks as if it were erupting from below. There are sporadic bloinks beneath the maple. Why is this drop so different from the hemlock drips? I step in close to watch the way that water moves on maple. The drops don't form just anywhere along the stem. They arise mostly where past year's bud scars have formed a tiny ridge. The rainwater sheets over the smooth green bark and gets dammed up behind the wall of the bud scar. It swells and gathers until it tops the little dam and spills over, tumbling in a massive drop to the water below. Bloink. Shh from rain, pit, pit, pit from hemlock, bloink from maple, and lastly, pop of falling alder water. Alder drops make a slow music. It takes time for fine rain to traverse the scabrous, rough surface of an alder leaf. The drops aren't as big as maple drops, not enough to splash, but the pop ripples the surface and sends out concentric rings. I close my eyes and listen to the voices of the rain. The reflecting surface of the pool is textured with their signatures, each one different in pace and resonance. Every drip, it seems, is changed by its relationship with life, whether it encounters moss or maple or fir bark or my hair. And we think of it as simply rain, as if it were one thing, as if we understood it. I think that moss knows rain better than we do, and so do maples. Maybe there's no such thing as rain. There are only raindrops, each with its own story. Listening to rain, time disappears. If time is measured by the period between events, alder drip time is different from maple drip. This forest is textured with different kinds of time, as the surface of the pool is dimpled with different kinds of rain. Fir needles fall with the high-frequency hiss of rain. Branches fall with the bloink of big drops. And trees fall with a rare but thunderous thud. Rare, unless you measure time like a river. And we think of it as simply time, as if it were one thing, as if we understood it. Maybe there is no such thing as time. There are only moments, each with its own story. I can see my face reflected in a dangling drop. The fisheye lens give me a giant forehead and tiny ears. I suppose that's the way we humans are, thinking too much and listening too little. Paying attention acknowledges that we have something to learn from intelligences other than our own. Listening, standing witness, creates an openness to the world in which the boundaries between us can dissolve in a raindrop. The drop swells on the tip of a cedar, and I catch it on my tongue, like a blessing. Burning sweetgrass. A sweetgrass braid is burned to create a ceremonial smudge that washes the recipient in kindness and compassion, to heal the body and the spirit. Wendigo footprints. In the winter brilliance, the only sounds are the rub of my jacket against itself, the soft plump of my snowshoes, the rifle shot crack of trees bursting their hearts in the freezing temperatures, and the beating of my own heart, pumping hot blood, fingers still tingling in double mittens. In the break between squalls, the sky is painfully blue. The snowfields sparkle below like shattered glass. This last storm has sculpted the drifts like surf on a frozen sea. Earlier, my tracks were filled with pink and yellow shadows, Now they deepen to blue in the fading light. I walk alongside fox tracks, vole tunnels, and a bright red spatter in the snow, framed by the imprint of hawk wings. Everybody's hungry. When the wind picks up again, I can smell more snow coming, and within minutes the squall line roars over the treetops, carrying flakes like a gray curtain blowing straight at me. I turn to get to shelter before full dark, retracing my steps, which have already begun to fill. When I look more closely, I can see that inside each of my tracks is another print that is not my tread. I scan the growing darkness for a figure, but the snow is too heavy to see. The trees thrash beneath racing clouds. A howl rises behind me. Maybe it's just the wind. It's on nights like this that the Wendigo is afoot. You can hear its unearthly shrieks as it hunts through the blizzard. The Wendigo is the legendary monster of our Anishinaabe people, the villain of a tale told on freezing nights in the North Woods. You can feel it lurking behind you, a being in the shape of an outsized man, 10 feet tall, with frost-white hair hanging from its shaking body. With arms like tree trunks, feet as big as snowshoes, it travels easily through the blizzards of the hungry time, stalking us. The hideous stench of its carrion breath poisons the clean scent of snow as it pants behind us. Yellow fangs hang from its mouth that is raw where it has chewed off its lips from hunger. Most telling of all, its heart is made of ice. Wendigo stories were told around the fire to scare children into safe behavior, lest this Ojibwe boogeyman make a meal of them, or worse. This monster is no bear or howling wolf, no natural beast. Wendigos are not born. They are made. The Wendigo is a human being who has become a cannibal monster. Its bite will transform victims into cannibals, too. When I come in from the rising blizzard and peel off my ice-coated clothes, there is a fire in the wood stove and a simmering pot of stew. It wasn't always that way for our people, when the storms would bury the lodges and the food was gone. They named this time, when the snow is too deep and the deer are gone and the caches are empty, the hunger moon. It is the time when an elder leaves to hunt and never returns. When sucking a bone is not enough, the infants follow. After too many days, desperation is the only soup. Starvation in winter was a reality for our people, particularly in the era of the Little Ice Age, when winters were especially hard and long. Some scholars suggest that Wendigo mythology also spread quickly in the time of the fur trade, when overexploitation of game brought famine to the villages. The ever-present fear of winter famine is embodied in the icy hunger and gaping maw of the Wendigo. As the monster shrieked on the wind, the Wendigo stories reinforced the taboo against cannibalism, when the madness of hunger and isolation rustled at the edge of winter lodges. Succumbing to such a repulsive urge doomed the gnawer of bones to wander as a Wendigo for the rest of time. It is said that the Wendigo will never enter the spirit world, but will suffer the eternal pain of need, its essence a hunger that will never be sated. The more a Wendigo eats, the more ravenous it becomes. It shrieks with its craving, its mind a torture of unmet wants. Consumed by consumption, it lays waste to humankind. But the Wendigo is more than just a mythic monster intended to frighten children. Creation stories offer a glimpse into the worldview of a people, of how they understand themselves, their place in the world, and the ideals to which they aspire. Likewise, the collective fears and deepest values of a people are also seen in the visage of the monsters they create. Born of our fears and our failings, Wendigo is the name for that within us which cares more for its own survival than for anything else. In terms of system science, the Wendigo is a case study of a positive feedback loop in which a change in one entity promotes a similar change in another connected part of the system. In this case, an increase in Wendigo hunger causes an increase in Wendigo eating, and that increased eating promotes only more rampant hunger in an eventual frenzy of uncontrolled consumption. In the natural as well as the built environment, positive feedback leads inexorably to change, sometimes to growth, sometimes to destruction. When growth is unbalanced, however, you can't always tell the difference. Stable, balanced systems are typified by negative feedback loops, in which a change in one component incites an opposite change in another, so they balance each other out. When hunger causes increased eating, eating causes decreased hunger. Satiety is possible. Negative feedback is a form of reciprocity, a coupling of forces that create balance and sustainability. Wendigo stories sought to encourage negative feedback loops in the minds of listeners. Traditional upbringing was designed to strengthen self-discipline, to build resistance against the insidious germ of taking too much. The old teachings recognize that Wendigo nature is in each of us, so the monster was created in stories that we might learn why we should recoil from that greedy part of ourselves. This is why Anishinaabe elders like Stuart King remind us to always acknowledge the two faces, the light and the dark side of life, in order to understand ourselves. See the dark, recognize its power, but do not feed it. The beast has been called an evil spirit that devours mankind. The very word Wendigo, according to Ojibwe scholar Basil Johnston, can be derived from roots meaning fat excess, or thinking only of oneself. Writer Steve Pitt says that a Wendigo was a human whose selfishness has overpowered their self-control to the point that satisfaction is no longer possible. No matter what they call it, Johnston and many other scholars point to the current epidemic of self-destructive practices, addiction to alcohol, drugs, gambling, technology, and more, as a sign that Wendigo is alive and well. In Ojibwe ethics, Pitt says, any overindulgent habit is self-destructive, and self-destruction is Wendigo. And just as Wendigo's bite is infectious, we all know too well that self-destruction drags along many more victims in our human families as well as in the more-than-human world. The native habitat of the Wendigo is the North Woods, but the range has expanded in the last few centuries. As Johnston suggests, multinational corporations have spawned a new breed of Wendigo that insatiably devours the Earth's resources, not for need, but for greed. The footprints are all around us, once you know what to look for. Our plane had to land for repairs on a short paved strip in the jungle at the heart of the Ecuadorian Amazon oil fields, a few miles from the Colombian border. We flew in over unbroken rainforest, following the river shining like a blue satin ribbon below. But the water abruptly turned black when we flew over the raw gashes of red soil, marking the paths of pipelines. Our hotel was on a dirt street, where dead dogs and prostitutes shared the corners under a perpetually orange sky lit by the flaring stacks. When we got the room key, the concierge told us to push a dresser against the door and not leave our rooms during the night. In the lobby was a cage of scarlet macaws, staring dully at the street where half-naked children were begging and AK-47s hung from the shoulders of boys no older than 12, standing guard outside the houses of the narco-traffickers. We passed the night without incident. The next morning, we flew out as the sun rose over the steaming jungle. Below us was the snarling town, ringed with rainbow-colored lagoons of petrochemical waste, too many to count. The footprints of the Wendigo. They're everywhere you look. They stomp in the industrial sludge of Onondaga Lake, and over a savagely clear-cut slope in the Oregon Coast Range, where the earth is slumping into the river. You can see them where coal mines rip off mountaintops in West Virginia, and in oil-slick footprints on the beaches of the Gulf of Mexico. A square mile of industrial soybeans, a diamond mine in Rwanda, a closet stuffed with clothes. Wendigo footprints all, they are the tracks of insatiable consumption. So many have been bitten. You can see them walking the malls, eyeing your farm for a housing development, running for Congress. We are all complicit. We've allowed the market to define what we value, so that the redefined common good seems to depend on profligate lifestyles that enrich the sellers while impoverishing the soul and the earth. Cautionary Wendigo tales arose in a commons-based society where sharing was essential to survival, and greed made any individual a danger to the whole. In the old times, individuals who endangered the community by taking too much for themselves were first counseled, then ostracized, and if the greed continued, they were eventually banished. The Wendigo myth may have arisen from the remembrance of the banished, doomed to wander hungry and alone, wreaking vengeance on the ones who spurned them. It is a terrible punishment to be banished from the web of reciprocity with no one to share with you and no one for you to care for. I remember walking a street in Manhattan where the warm light of a lavish home spilled out over the sidewalk on a man picking through the garbage for his dinner. Maybe we've all been banished to lonely corners by our obsession with private property. We've accepted banishment even from ourselves when we spend our beautiful, utterly singular lives on making more money to buy more things that feed but never satisfy. It is the Wendigo way that tricks us into believing that belongings will fill our hunger when it is belonging that we crave. On a grander scale, too, we seem to be living in an era of Wendigo economics, of fabricated demand and compulsive overconsumption. What native peoples once sought to rein in, we are now asked to unleash in a systematic policy of sanctioned greed. The fear for me is far greater than just acknowledging the Wendigo within. The fear for me is that the world has been turned inside out, the dark side made to seem light. Indulgent self-interest that our people once held to be monstrous is now celebrated as success. We are asked to admire what our people viewed as unforgivable. The consumption-driven mindset masquerades as quality of life, but eats us from within. It is as if we've been invited to a feast, but the table is laid with food that nourishes only emptiness, the black hole of the stomach that never fills. We have unleashed a monster. Ecological economists argue for reforms that would ground economics in ecological principles and the constraints of thermodynamics. They urge the embrace of the radical notion that we must sustain natural capital and ecosystem services if we are to maintain quality of life. But governments still cling to the neoclassical fallacy that human consumption has no consequences. We continue to embrace economic systems that prescribe infinite growth on a finite planet, as if somehow the universe had repealed the laws of thermodynamics on our behalf. Perpetual growth is simply not compatible with natural law. And yet a leading economist like Lawrence Summers of Harvard, the World Bank, and the U.S. National Economic Council issue such statements as, "There are no limits to the carrying capacity of the Earth that are likely to bind at any time in the foreseeable future." The idea that we should put limits on growth because of some natural limit is a profound error. Our leaders willfully ignore the wisdom and the models of every other species on the planet, except, of course, those that have gone extinct. Wendigo thinking. The Sacred and the Superfund. Above the spring behind my house, a drop forms at the end of a mossy branch, hangs in a momentary sparkle, and then lets go. Other drips and drops join in the procession, just a few of the hundreds of rivulets from these hills. Gathering speed, they splish over rocky ledges with growing urgency to be on their way, down Nine Mile Creek, until they find Onondaga Lake. I cup my hands to the spring and drink. Knowing what I know, I worry about the journey these drops will soon take, wanting to hold them here forever. But there is no stopping water. The watershed of my home in upstate New York lies within the ancestral homelands of the Onondaga people, the central fire of the Iroquois or Haudenosaunee Confederacy. Traditional Onondaga understand a world in which all beings were given a gift that simultaneously engenders a responsibility to the world. Water's gift is its role as life sustainer, and its duties are manifold, making plants grow, creating home for fish and mayflies, and for me today, offering a cool drink. The particular sweetness of this water comes from the surrounding hills, great shoulders of inordinately pure, fine-grained limestone. These old sea floors are almost pure calcium carbonate, with scarcely a trace of other elements to discolor their pearly gray. Other springs in these hills are less sweet, emerging from limestone shelves that hide salt-filled caverns, crystal palaces lined with cubes of halite. The Onondaga use these salt springs to season their corn soup and venison and preserve the baskets of fish the waters offered up. Life was good, and water rushed off to do its work, faithful to its responsibility every day. But people are not always as mindful as water. We can forget. And so the Haudenosaunee were given the Thanksgiving address to remind themselves to greet and thank all of the members of the natural world whenever they gathered. To the waters, they say, "We give thanks to all the waters of the world. We are grateful that the waters are still here and doing their duty of sustaining life on Mother Earth. Water is life, quenching our thirst and providing us with strength, making the plants grow and sustaining us all. Let us gather our minds together, and with one mind, we send greetings and thanks to the waters." These words reflect the sacred purpose of the people. For just as water was given certain responsibilities for sustaining the world, so were the people. Chief among their duties was to give thanks for the gifts of the earth and to care for them. Stories are told of long ago times when the Haudenosaunee people did forget to live in gratitude. They became greedy and jealous and began fighting among themselves, Conflict brought only more conflict, until war between the nations became continuous. Soon grief was known in every longhouse, and yet the violence went on. All were suffering. During that sorry time, a son was born to a Huron woman, far to the west. This handsome youth grew to manhood, knowing that he had a special purpose. One day, he explained to his family that he must leave home to carry a message to people in the east, a message from the Creator. He built a great canoe, carved of white stone, and journeyed far until at last he pulled his boat ashore in the midst of the warring Haudenosaunee. Here he spoke his message of peace and became known as the Peacemaker. Few heeded him at first, but those who listened were transformed. His life in danger, weighed down with sorrow, the Peacemaker and his allies, among them the real Hiawatha, spoke peace in times of terrible trouble. For years they traveled between villages, and one by one, the chiefs of the warring nations came to accept the message of peace. All but one. Tododaho, an Onondaga leader, refused the way of peace for his people. He was so filled with hate that his hair writhed with snakes and his body was crippled by vitriol. Tododaho sent death and sorrow to the carriers of the message. But the peace was more powerful than he, and eventually the Onondaga, too, accepted the message of peace. Tododaho's twisted body was restored to health, and together the messengers of peace combed the snakes from his hair. He, too, was transformed. The Peacemaker gathered together the leaders of all five Haudenosaunee nations and joined them with one mind. The great tree of peace, an enormous white pine, has five long green needles joined in one bundle, representing the unity of the five nations. With one hand, the Peacemaker lifted the great tree from the soil, and the assembled chiefs stepped forward to cast their weapons of war into the hole. On this very shore, the nations agreed to bury the hatchet and live by the great law of peace, which sets out right relations among peoples and with the natural world. Four white roots spread out to the four directions, inviting all peace-loving nations to shelter under the tree's branches. So was born the great Haudenosaunee Confederacy, the oldest living democracy on the planet. It was here, at Onondaga Lake, where this great law was born. For its pivotal role, the Onondaga Nation became the central fire of the Confederacy, and from that time forward, the name Tododaho has been carried by the spiritual leader of the Confederacy. As a final measure, the Peacemaker placed the far-seeing eagle atop the great tree to warn the people of approaching danger. For the many centuries that followed, the eagle did its work, and the Haudenosaunee people lived in peace and prosperity. But then another danger, a different kind of violence, came to their homelands. The great bird must have called and called, but its voice was lost in the maelstrom winds of change. Today, the ground where the Peacemaker walked is a Superfund site. In fact, 9 Superfund sites line the shore of Onondaga Lake, around which the present-day city of Syracuse, New York, has grown. Thanks to more than a century of industrial development, the lake, known as one of North America's most sacred sites, is now known as one of the most polluted lakes in the United States. Drawn by abundant resources and the coming of the Erie Canal, the captains of industry brought their innovations to Onondaga territory. Early journals record that smokestacks made the air a choking miasma. The manufacturers were happy to have Onondaga Lake so close at hand, to use as a dumping ground. Millions of tons of industrial waste were slurried onto the lake bottom. The growing city followed suit, adding sewage to the suffering of the waters. It is as if the newcomers to Onondaga Lake had declared war, not on each other, but with the land. Today, the land where the peacemaker walked and the tree of peace stood isn't land at all, but beds of industrial waste, 60 feet deep. It sticks to shoes like thick white school paste used in kindergartens to glue cutout birds onto construction paper trees. There aren't too many birds here, and the Tree of Peace is buried. The original people could no longer find even the familiar curve of the shore. The old contours were filled in, creating a new shoreline of more than a mile of waste beds. It has been said that the waste beds made new land, but that is a lie. The waste beds are actually old land, chemically rearranged. This greasy sludge used to be limestone and fresh water and rich soil. The new terrain is old land that has been pulverized, extracted, and poured out the end of a pipe. It is known as Solvay waste, after the Solvay process company that left it behind. The Solvay process was a chemical breakthrough that allowed for the production of soda ash, an essential component of other industrial processes such as glass manufacturing and making detergents, pulp, and paper. Native limestone was melted in coke-fired furnaces and then reacted with salt to produce soda ash. This industry fueled the growth of the whole region, and chemical processing expanded to include organic chemicals, dyes, and chlorine gas. Train lines ran steadily past the factories, shipping out tons of products. Pipes ran in the other direction, pouring out tons of waste. The hills of waste are the topographic inverse of the open pit mines, the largest open pit mines in New York State, still unreclaimed. Where the limestone rocks were quarried, the earth gouged out in one place to bury the ground in another. If time could run backward, like a film in reverse, we would see this mess reassemble itself into lush green hills and moss-covered ledges of limestone. The streams would run back up the hills to the springs, and the salt would stay glittering in underground rooms. I can too easily imagine what it must have been like, those first ejections from the pipe falling in chalky white splats like the droppings of an enormous mechanical bird, splurting and pulsing at first with air in the mile-long intestine that stretched back to the gut of the factory. But it would soon settle into a steady flow, burying the reeds and rushes. Did the frogs and mink get away in time to avoid being entombed? What about the turtles? Too slow. They wouldn't be able to escape being embedded at the bottom of the pile in a perversion of the story of the world's creation when the earth was carried on turtles' back. First, they filled in the lakeshore itself, sending tons of sludge into the waters in a plume that turned blue water to white paste. Then they moved the end of the pipe to the surrounding wetlands, right up to the edges of the stream. The water of Nine Mile Creek must have wanted to head back uphill to defy gravity and find again the mossy pools beneath the springs. But it kept to its work and found its way, seeping through the waste beds and out to the lake. Rain bound for waste beds is in trouble too. At first, the waste particles are so fine that they trap the water in white clay. Then gravity eventually pulls the drops through 60 feet of sludge and out the bottom of the pile to join a drainage ditch instead of a stream. As it passes through the chalky depths, The rain cannot help doing what it has been called to do, dissolving minerals, carrying ions intended to nurture plants and fish. By the time it reaches the bottom of the heap, the water has picked up enough chemicals to be as salty as soup and as corrosive as lye. Its beautiful name, water, is lost. It's now called leachate. Leachate seeps from the waste beds with a pH of 11. Like drain cleaner, it will burn your skin. Normal drinking water has a pH value of 7. Today, engineers collect the leachate and mix it with hydrochloric acid in order to neutralize the pH. It is then released to Nine Mile Creek and out into Onondaga Lake. The water has been tricked. It started on its way, full of innocence, full of its own purpose. Through no fault of its own, it has been corrupted, and instead of being a bearer of life, it must now deliver poison. And yet it cannot stop itself from flowing. It must do what it must do with the gifts bestowed upon it by the Creator. It's only people who have a choice. Today, you can drive a motorboat on the lake the Peacemaker paddled. From across the water, the western shore stands out in sharp relief. Bright white bluffs gleam in the summer sun like the white cliffs of Dover. But when you approach by water, you'll see that the cliffs are not rock at all, but sheer walls of Solvay waste. While your boat bobs on the waves, you can see erosion gullies in the wall, the weather conspiring to mix the waste into the lake. Summer sun dries out the pasty surface until it blows, and sub-zero winter temperatures fracture it off in plates that fall to the water. A beach beckons around the point, but there are no swimmers, no docks. This bright white expanse is a flat plain of waste that slumped into the water when a retaining wall collapsed many years ago. A white pavement of settled waste extends far out from shore, barely underwater. The smooth shelf is punctuated by cobble-sized rocks, ghostly beneath the water, unlike any rock you know. These are oncolites, accretions of calcium carbonate that pepper the lake bottom. Oncolites, tumorous rocks. Pilings stick up through the flat like a backbone, remnants of the old retaining wall. Here and there, rusted pipes that carried the sludge stick out at odd angles. Where the sludge piles meet the flats of Solvay, there are small trickling seeps that are eerily reminiscent of springs, but the liquid that emerges seems slightly thicker than water. There are plates of summer ice along the little rivulets that drain toward the lake, crystal sheets made of salt, beneath which the water bubbles like a melting stream at the end of winter. The waste beds continue to leach tons of salt into the lake every year. Before the Allied Chemical Company, successor to Solvay Process, ceased operation, the salinity of Onondaga Lake was 10 times the salinity of the headwaters of Nine Mile Creek. The salt, the oncolites, and the waste impede the growth of rooted aquatic plants. Lakes rely on their submerged plants to generate oxygen by photosynthesis. Without plants, the depths of Onondaga Lake are oxygen poor, and without swaying beds of vegetation, fish, frogs, insects, herons, the whole food chain are left without habitat. While rooted water plants have a hard time, floating algae flourish in Onondaga Lake. For decades, high quantities of nitrogen and phosphorus from municipal sewage fertilized the lake and fueled their growth. Algae blooms cover the surface of the water, then die and sink to the bottom. Their decay depletes what little oxygen is in the water, and the lake begins to smell of the dead fish that wash up on shore on hot summer days. The fish that survive, you may not eat. Fishing was banned in 1970 due to high concentrations of mercury. It is estimated that 165,000 pounds of mercury were discharged into Onondaga Lake between 1946 and 1970. Allied Chemical used the mercury cell process to produce industrial chlorine from the native salt brines. The mercury waste, which we know to be extremely toxic, was handled freely on its way to disposal in the lake. Local people recall that a kid could make good pocket money on reclaimed mercury. One old-timer told me that you could go out to the waste beds with a kitchen spoon and pick up the small, glistening spheres of mercury that lay on the ground. A kid could fill an old canning jar with mercury and sell it back to the company for the price of a movie ticket. Inputs of mercury were sharply curtailed in the 1970s, but the mercury remains trapped in the sediments. When methylated, it can circulate through the aquatic food chain. It is estimated that 7 million cubic yards of lake sediments are today contaminated with mercury. A sampling core drilled into the lake bottom cuts through sludge, trapped layers of discharged gas, oil, and sticky black ooze. Analysis of these cores reveals significant concentrations of cadmium, barium, chromium, cobalt, lead, benzene, chlorobenzene, assorted xylenes, pesticides, and PCBs. Not many insects, and not many fish. Onondaga Lake in the 1880s was famed for its whitefish, served freshly caught on steaming platters along potatoes boiled in salty brine. Fine restaurants did a booming business along the lakeshore, where tourists came for the scenery, the amusement parks, and picnic grounds where families spread their blankets on a Sunday afternoon. A trolley delivered passengers to the grand hotels that lined its shore. One famed resort, White Beach, featured a long wooden slide lit with strings of glittering gas lights. Holidaymakers would sit in wheeled carts and whoosh down the ramp to splash into the lake below. The resort promised an exhilarating dowsing for ladies, gentlemen, and children of all ages. But swimming was banned in 1940. Beautiful Onondaga Lake. People spoke of it with pride. Now they barely speak of it at all, as if it were a family member whose demise was so shameful that the name never comes up. You would think that such toxic waters would be nearly transparent with the absence of life, but some areas are often nearly opaque with a dark cloud of silt. The turbidity comes from a muddy plume that enters the lake from another tributary, Onondaga Creek. It flows in from the south, from the high ridge above the Tully Valley, from hillsides of forests, farms, and sweet-smelling apple orchards. Muddy water is usually attributed to runoff from farmland, but in this case, the mud comes from below. High in the watershed are the Tully mud boils, which erupt into the creek like mud volcanoes, sending tons of soft sediment downstream. There is some debate as to whether the mud boils are of natural geologic origin. The Onondaga elders remember when, not so long ago, Onondaga Creek ran so clear through their nation that they could spearfish by lantern light. They knew that there was no mud in the creek until salt mining began upstream. When the salt wells near the factories ran out, Allied Chemical used solution mining to access the underground salt deposits up near the headwaters. The company pumped water into subterranean deposits, dissolved them away, and then pumped the brine miles down the valley to the Solvay plant. The brine line was run through the remaining territory of the Onondaga Nation, where breaks in the line ruined the well water. Eventually, the dissolved salt domes collapsed underground, creating holes through which groundwater pushed with high pressure. The resulting gushers created the mud boils that flow downstream and fill the lake with sediment. The creek that was once a fishery for Atlantic salmon, a swimming hole for kids, and a focal point of community life, now runs as brown as chocolate milk. Allied Chemical and its successors deny any role in the formation of the mud boils. They claim it was an act of God. What kind of God would that be? The wounds to these waters are as numerous as the snakes in the Tadadaho's hair, and they must be named before they can be combed out. The ancestral Onondaga territory stretches from the Pennsylvania border north to Canada. It was a mosaic of rich woodlands, expansive cornfields, clear lakes and rivers that sustained the native people for centuries. The original territory also encompasses the site of present-day Syracuse and the sacred shores of Onondaga Lake. Onondaga rights to these lands were guaranteed by treaties between the two sovereign nations, Onondaga Nation and the United States government. But water is more faithful to its responsibilities than the United States would ever be. When George Washington directed federal troops to exterminate the Onondaga during the Revolutionary War, a nation that had numbered in the tens of thousands was reduced to a few hundred people in a matter of 1 year. Afterward, every single treaty was broken. Illegal takings of land by the state of New York diminished the Aboriginal Onondaga territories to a reservation of only 4,300 acres. The Onondaga Nation territory today